Good morning. Welcome to everyone. Especially glad for the Martin visitors here. So, welcome. And anyone else if I'm missing? Just for information's sake, Bible school is starting next Sunday, I guess. So, we'll be gone the next three Sundays there. Appreciate your prayers. And thank you to all of you that have shared already this morning. I appreciate the thought there, Brian, so far as last year. I sort of struggle with that as well. At the same time, I realize I haven't lost my parents or whatever to COVID, so it's maybe more detached for me in some ways. At the same time, I thank God, even if somebody would have experienced that, God still has a way of making it. Maybe not a pain. It could have still been a painful year, but it could still be good in God's way, even through the pain. So, may God bless each one in that. Afraid the message I have is one of those inspirations that sound good till I get to the time of preaching. Then I'm like, why did I ever do this? But it's a somewhat unorthodox at best, probably, and maybe somewhat flies in the face of what I would perceive as Mennonite orthodoxy. So I guess what I'll do is I'll just share what I have, and with that, in testimony time or otherwise, you just correct where I go astray. So the title I put on this is Unboxing God. Unboxing God. Before I get into the main part, I realize that, like we say, a coin has two sides. And I know, and I think to some degree understand that man, as man, we cannot put God in a box. I want that clear. Yet somehow just knowing that I can't put God in a box doesn't seemingly at least keep this, shall we say, foolish person from at least trying it at times. And maybe as I share more, you'll understand where I'm coming from. And so yes, in a way, there's no way we can unbox God because he never was in a box to start with. At the same time, as my view of God is formed, sometimes I think I at least have a problem of trying to put him in a box, and maybe he needs to come out, and we'll try to make that coherent as we go. Okay, so just for illustration purposes, to at least keep this as simple as we can, what comes in a box like this? A phone. And there's actually a phone in here. So let's say with that phone that's in this box, if I open this box and take this phone out, is it any different in its capabilities than it is currently? It's the exact same phone, right? It can do the same things, has the same connections, perform the same functions. So the phone stays the same, yet can I use the phone while it's in a box? Not really. I can feel good that I own this phone. I can be sort of proud that it's still in the box. It's new. I could maybe sell it, potentially. This one doesn't have the plastic wrapping on it anymore, so you would have to take my word for it that it was never out, which this one was. But, so while the phone has the same capabilities, and it doesn't change the phone if I take it out of the box, at the same time, for this phone to be a benefit, a tool for me, it has to come out of its box. Otherwise, it's limited in its functionality because it's in a box. Taking the phone out of the box does not change the phone, the nature, its function, but it does change the nature and function of my relationship with it, because as long as I'm trying to relate to that phone through the box, I can't use it. Anytime we hear of someone or something secondhand, we form a mental picture. Maybe some of us realize that more than others. We form a mental picture of them or it, and begin forming opinions that stem from that mental picture. So just for example, how many of you know and believe there's a country like Mexico? Okay, so we pretty well get along on that one. So how many of you have been in Mexico? Quite a few, okay. Let's see, is there somebody that has not been in Mexico that would care if I would ask you a couple questions about Mexico? Anybody willing to be a guinea pig for me there? So, Peanut, you weren't in Mexico, thank you. What do you know about Mexico? Just tell us some general, just two or three general things, nothing. Okay. Do what?
I think.
Oh, you think? Okay. Anything more you want to say about Mexico? Talk Spanish. Is it a place you would just love to drive through the middle of the night? Okay, why not? Oh, robberies. Okay, gotcha. Okay, I think that suffices. Now, does somebody that has been in Mexico want to do the same thing for me? Jonas, may I pick on you? You've been there. So you've actually even been brave enough to drive your family down through. I don't know if it was the middle of the night, but haven't you? So is Peanut right about Mexico? Is it hot and maybe cold up on top of a mountain? At least that's how I took him. Okay. Let's see, what was the other thing was he said? Oh, about traveling. Have you got robbed? Yeah. Okay. Good enough. So do you know everything about Mexico? I don't guess any of us that have been there know everything about it. So Peanut, back to you. Where did you learn what you did? Had you talked to Jonas about Mexico before? Okay. Books, media of different types. So even like, let's take for instance, I think probably myself included would have a bit of trepidation about traveling through Mexico for, I have traveled there, but just as far as driving down through there long term with my family, it'd be something I would at least think about twice. Why would that be? Where did I form that conclusion? And so, please understand, I'm not saying that some of the things that Peanut or I know about Mexico are necessarily false. There is often some elements of truth in this. Yet, at the same time, let's remember that that's not the sum total of what Mexico is, right? Some people go there for doctors. In fact, it was interesting, just this week, somebody that has traveled in Mexico extensively was telling me about somebody that lives in Mexico, and he said, you're Americans. Every time the one that lives in Mexico comes up here, he said, so many Americans are like, oh, how is it? Is it safe? I mean, did you get shot at recently? Or, you know, on and on. And he's like, y'all are so silly. He said, he feels safer in Mexico than he does up here after all. He said, especially after some of the abductions that happened in the last year and things, thinking of one in Pennsylvania and in New Mexico were specifically mentioned. He said, as Mennonite people, we've not had anything like that happen in Mexico. And so, you know, it all depends. So if you were to give a Mexican some of the news media from up here and just give him the scary or the bad things, he could form a pretty phenomenal idea about what life in Arkansas is about too, whereas we feel somewhat comfortable, or at least I do. Maybe just to reinforce this, let's do one more. How many of you know Michael Hofer? Know the name? Okay, there's a few less of you. So do you think those of us here that think we know Michael Hofer, he lives in Alberta, Canada, I consider him a friend even though he's not, haven't had the opportunity to observe him closely, I guess, long term. Do you think we could form a correct view of Michael Hofer amongst us here? I could tell you he's a fairly sensitive and conscientious person, and you could start forming your opinion of him. We could tell you he's, I don't know if he's tall, he's taller than I am, dark and not as pudgy. So you could keep adding to that, you know, we could go. And I don't know what the rest of you know, and we won't necessarily dissect the poor man right now since he's not here to defend himself. But, you know, if we would bring, let's say, somebody from the church he goes to here, they could tell you a lot more than what I could, probably how he is under stress and all that. If we'd bring one of his children or his wife here, they could tell you even more. At the same time, until you lived with him and worked with him, the chances are pretty high that even after somebody very close to him would have told you, if you would have the opportunity to live and work with him closely, at the end of a year or two, you could tell them, well, you didn't tell me one of them, maybe to you, more outstanding things about him, because now you have a personal relationship that transcends the other. So in thinking about this, all of us I would say, have formed our view of God, who he is, what he does, and why he does as he does, through somewhat the same process, right? Has any of you just necessarily met God face to face without any intermediary, any other teacher, and just got to know him? I would say all of us, from the very youngest age, when we first sort of know that God is somewhere, something, we start forming this mental image that we slowly build upon block by block, piece by piece. And that's not wrong. That's not, I want that clear. That's not wrong. It's a natural process. And for those of us who have heard of God from an early age, those of us who, whether we had that or not, have spent a number of years seeking God, inevitably begin this process of building a mind picture, I will call it, made up of thoughts, opinions, ideas of who and what God is. While this is unavoidable, I would like to suggest to you that if we just allow that thing a totally natural process and follow our natural tendencies and inclinations to their end, we will, I would say, without fail, end up with a distorted view that's different from the real. You agree with me there? That, I guess basically, if I was to say it another way, to have a correct view of God will take work on my part. I can't just take what other people tell me, accurate as it may be, it's not complete. And even as I read the Bible, without a casual reading of the Bible is not necessarily going to give an unbeliever a correct view of God. He may be able to get some things, but it's not going to be correct. It takes effort. So therefore, I would like to propose that all of us end up with distortions, if you want to call it that, areas where we do not see God correctly. These distortions, if left unchecked and unchanged, may with time and circumstances become a kind of a box. A clearly defined, comfortable, knowable package. You know, as long as the phone is in the box, I can tell you all the specifications. I can tell you how much it weighs. I could tell you the screen size. I could tell you a lot of things. It's clearly defined. It's got a lot of writing here. And what doesn't say here, I could find elsewhere. But at the end of the day, I could give that knowledge to somebody that has never seen a phone like that in their life, and they could pass tell you the same thing verbally. But yet, if they were to take it out of the box, they would have absolutely no idea how it functions. You follow? Just the knowledge of the specifications of the phone doesn't lead to the ability to use the phone. And so just the head knowledge, just having this, if you want to, sounds almost wrong to do this, but just to say that you have the God's specifications down on your spreadsheet and you know exactly how to read off that God is this and this, does not really lead to a working relationship with God. Like I said already, a box limits the effectiveness and usefulness of a phone. And also, if God is in a box in my life, it will limit his usefulness and effectiveness in my life. Because the tendency is that a box is neat, a box is defined. Especially more, even more so when we're thinking of God in a box. When you have God outside of a box, he may ask something of me that... Back in the days when Alcoholics Anonymous was a bit more of a God-centric organization, a prayer that's a form of this prayer is included in many of their steps. And it goes something like this in part. Dear God, please set aside anything I think I know about myself, about my alcoholism, about all spiritual terms, and especially about you, God, so that I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. So consider that for a bit. Dear God, please set aside or help me set aside anything I think I know about myself, about my disease, alcoholism, about all spiritual terms, and especially about you, God, so that I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. And I want to be careful. I'm not necessarily trying to promote everything maybe they promote, but that prayer blessed me in that I think oftentimes as Christian people, we come to God having almost presupposed and predetermined what he is supposed to be and do in every given situation. And when he doesn't fit in our box, we start having spiritual issues because God isn't acting like we suppose God is supposed to act. May I propose to you that maybe it would be just as good to have a 10th generation Anabaptist that's never drunk alcohol to pray a similar prayer as it was for an alcoholic. Because I really think God wants us to show us something. So I'd like to go to a passage in the Bible that I think is well known to us, but I think where also makes us a bit nervous. So go to Judges chapter 6. Judges chapter 6. I've heard this account read, discussed many times. And I would say throughout my life, in all the circles I've been part of a sharing on this, I would have often sensed a basic discomfort and unease about this man and about how he related to God. And I wonder if it's possibly because we're missing something in our view of God, of trying to keep God in a box. Judges chapter 6, verse 11 is where I'll begin reading. And I'd like to tell you that first we read about Gideon here. I would say Gideon was a man that had God in a box. So just briefly, I didn't want to just spend all morning reading Judges here. So just briefly, Israel wasn't serving God as a whole anyways. And so God left these Midianites to come in, take over, and they would steal, take away everything they could. And so God sent a prophet telling them basically to repent, to turn to him, and he would help them. Then we come to verse 11 in Judges chapter 6. And there came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak which was in Ophrah that pertained unto Joash, the Abzerite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him and said unto him, "The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." Now I want you to notice how Gideon had God in a box. And Gideon said unto him, "O my Lord, if the Lord be with us, why then is all this befallen us? And where be all his miracles which our fathers told us of, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord hath forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." I'll just pause there briefly. Think of Gideon. So he had heard. He knew what all God had done for Israel from, I would say, probably Abraham on up through. He knew that. And yet he had trouble reconciling what he was told that God had did in the past with the current circumstances. Sound familiar at all? You ever have a problem? I do. Trying to reconcile what I have been told God is and has done with what I am currently experiencing. See that very clearly in Gideon here. "Oh my Lord, if the Lord be with us, why then has this befallen us?" Where's God in all this? 14, the angel goes on, verse 14, "And the Lord looked upon him and said, Go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent thee?" So God sort of disregards the question. He says, "Go ahead, Gideon. Go do the job I have for you to do. I am sending you." Then notice, Gideon still had God in a box. Verse 15, "And he," Gideon, "said unto him," the angel, "O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I'm the least in my father's house." I guess his humility was good. For him to say that he was poor, he evidently had at least 10 servants, so I don't know what classified as poor in that day. It seems to me it was more an excuse. And God told him, "I'm sending you to do this job." And Gideon's like, "I can't do this job. I'm a nobody. How can I do this job? Because basically, if we go back to verse 13, because you're not helping and I don't have what it takes." Verse 16, "The Lord said unto him, Surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man." In other words, almost seems to me God is saying there, really all it takes is one obedient man for this, for my plan to be fulfilled. "I will be with thee." That should be enough. 17, "And he," Gideon, "said, If I have now found grace in thy sight, then show me a sign that thou talkest with me. Depart not hence, I pray thee, until I come unto thee and bring forth my present and set it before thee. And he said, I will tarry until thou come again. So the angel said he'd wait. And Gideon went in and made ready a kid and unleavened cakes of an ephah of flour, and the flesh he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and he brought it unto him under the oak and presented it. And the angel of God said unto him, Take the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and lay them upon this rock, and pour out the broth. And he did so. And the angel of the Lord put forth the end of his staff that was in his hand, and touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and there rose up fire out of the rock, and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. Then the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. So Gideon got his sign. He said, give me a sign. Wait here till I come back, and then give me a sign. Now, Gideon still had God in a box, verse 22. And when Gideon perceived that he was an angel of the Lord, Gideon said, alas, O Lord God, because I have seen an angel of the Lord face to face. Now, you have to understand a bit here. Israel at this point somehow had formed the philosophy, should we call it, the idea that to see God, or even to see an angel of God face to face, would cause death. And I think it basically came from Moses, actually. If you remember Moses in the mount, he wanted to see God face to face, and God said, no man can do that and live. So it was sort of a distortion. It wasn't, God had not said that you can't see my messenger. He said, you just can't see my face. But again, Gideon, having his presupposed view of God and trying to fit God desperately into his box, and yet it just wasn't working because the pieces just didn't go in. God's answer to Gideon on this one, verse 23, and the Lord said unto him, peace be unto thee, fear not, thou shalt not die. Again, God confirming to Gideon that I don't fit in your box. Give it up. Then Gideon built an altar there unto the Lord and called it Jehovah Shalom. Unto this day it is yet an Ophrah of the Abizurites. Going on to verse 25. In this God, I guess in this case you can say God was pushing Gideon to get him unboxed, if you want to use that term. With God becoming slowly unboxed in Gideon's life, it led to action. Verse 25, and it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, take thy father's young bullock, even the second bullock of 7 years old, and throw down the altar of Baal that thy father hath, and cut down the grove that is by it, and build an altar unto the Lord thy God upon the top of this rock in the ordered place, and take the second bullock and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the grove which thou shalt cut down. Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had said unto him. And so it was, because he feared his father's household and the men of the city, that he could not do it by day, but he did it by night. So now you have a person that went from, I can't do anything, to, well, I can at least start working at home. A good step. And he did what he had to because of fear at night. Again, I don't blame him for that at all. But then we see this was just a step in the relationship that God was seeking to build. Let's jump down to verse 36, what I call the building of the relationship between God and Gideon. And Gideon said unto God, if thou wilt save Israel by mine hand as thou hast said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool in the floor, and if the dew be upon the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the earth beside, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by my hand as thou hast said. So Gideon's still struggling. He says, God, okay, if I'm really supposed to do this, a nobody like me with nothing to do this with, no military experience likely, could you just help me here? Can I put this wool out here, and let's have the wool wet and the floor dry? And it was so, for when he rose up, verse 38, early on the morrow, and thrust the fleece together, and wringed the dew out of the fleece a bowl full of water. So he got some water out of the thing. And then Gideon said unto God, let not thine anger be hot against me. I will speak but this once more, I added. Let me prove or test, I pray thee, but this once with the fleece. Let it now be dry only upon the fleece, and upon all the ground let there be dew. So I don't know if Gideon was trying to wax scientific here or not. Did he somehow think that maybe God didn't do this fleece after all? Maybe somehow a dry wool, sheep wool sucks up all the dew around it and it's dry there and the wool's wet. So let's give it another go with the opposite. And verse 40, and God did so that night, for it was dry upon the fleece only, and there was dew on all the ground. Go down to chapter 7, verse 1. Then Jeroboam, who is Gideon, and all the people that were with him rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod. And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands. What kind of funny statement is that in military terms? But then he goes on and explains it. Lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, my hand hath saved me. God wanted it very clear to Gideon who was in control and why they were given victory, not because of numbers. So we have the various tests. I won't read that. How the ones that were afraid were told to go home, and then there were still too many, and so they were told to go drink water, and then the ones that drank in a guarded state were the ones that were able to continue on, whereas the ones that had drank in not a guarded state were told to go away, and he ended up with only 300. Verse 7, so down chapter 7, verse 7, and the Lord said unto Gideon, by the 300 men that lapped will I save you and deliver the Midianites into thine hand, and let all the other people go, every man unto his place. And it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, arise, get thee down unto the host, for I have delivered them into thine hand. Get up and go. But verse 10, but if thou fear to go down, go thou with Phurah thy servant down to the host, and thou shalt hear what they say, and afterward thine hand shall be strengthened to go down unto the host. And evidently Gideon still struggled even after all these things, because he went down and he heard this and then he went down with Phurah his servant unto the outside of the armed men that were in the host, and then he hears these two men talking, the dream and the prophecy. Okay, so the part that I've often heard people struggle with is this thing of asking for a sign. I thought maybe it was just me, so I ask around a bit. And it's not just me, I guess I would say, that has sensed this basic discomfort and unease we have about Gideon asking for signs from God. We sort of almost frame it up as being a weakness on his part, and I would like to disagree with that this morning. In my life, I've heard many cautions and negative admonitions on asking a sign from God. And I agree, it can be done wrong, and I want to cover some things on that. But I think this emphasis, this teaching that we have, may have led to wrong views and misrepresentation of the nature of God. I want you to notice this if you're in Judges there. Judges chapter 6, verse 39. And Gideon said unto God, let not thine anger be hot against me. I will speak but this once. Let me prove, or that word prove means test, I pray thee, again. And he had just done it twice already. So he asked permission to do it again, and God seemingly never spoke back against Gideon for doing that. Furthermore, I guess what I would like to point out is that even after all Gideon's struggle to have faith, to have confidence in moving ahead, at the very end there, when he was supposed to go and attack the camp, he said, God brought it up now, not Gideon. God brought it up and said, Gideon, if you're still struggling, go down to the camp and hear this. Isn't that God? Isn't that the grace of God mercifully giving Gideon even more than what he'd asked for? So why do we fault Gideon for having asked for it if God gave even more than what he asked for? A few other verses I think we need to consider as we think of this thing of asking for a sign is Malachi 3:10. He's telling Israel that you haven't brought the tithe. You haven't brought the offerings as you should have. And then in verse 10, he says, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house. God's saying this. And then he actually invites them. He says, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts. God actually invited Israel to come and try him. Come test me. See if I really am what I say I am. Do your part. Give a tithe in obedience. By all means, live a life of obedience. But then come and try me. See if I am what I said I am. To build on that, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 21, just grabbing a verse out of that portion, says, prove all things. Hold fast to that which is good. You know, if we're to prove all things, it means that we also have to prove God's work in our lives. And then we're supposed to cling to the good. Then I like to finish that up as Acts chapter 17, verse 11. I think it was Paul and I believe it was Silas at this point, may have been Barnabas. As they traveled, they come from Thessalonica, where they had been thrown out of the city, or sent away because of the danger, and they come to this town of Berea. And as they share the word there, it says, "These, the people in the city, were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind." In other words, they were open, yet in their openness, it says, they searched the scriptures daily, whether these things were so. So these weren't gullible people that just took and accepted anything, but they tried to match up what they were being told about God. Did it fit with what God had already said? Did it fit with what they'd experienced as they proved God through his word? So in consideration of these passages, it seems to me fundamentally unfair to God for us to say that he's against us asking him for confirmation. Furthermore, I would, maybe this is too strong, but as I've studied this and thought about this for quite a while, I would say that for God to say that we may not ask or prove him would actually be unfair to us. And I think this kind of thinking would really be contrary to the whole nature of God, who he really is. I want to read some more verses here, but as he explains himself as a father, what father has a problem with their child coming and saying, "Dad, I don't understand this. I've got a problem with this. Could you help me?" Yes, there's a time to just obey, but I don't think any natural father with a respectful child would have a problem with such a request. Getting into the dangers of this so that we can see the right way to do this, maybe, is a test or proving can be done for different motives and reasons. And you could split this a lot of ways. But first, it does seem there is some times, and I'll read some verses here in a minute, where a sign was asked for because there was a desire for the excitement of the experience, glamour, rather than a heart-seeking God. I think other times we read of in Scripture and definitely know of in life is where, because of doubt, of distrust, or maybe even an unwillingness to make a choice by faith, and so we try to get God or other people to convince us of truth when we need to accept it. And thirdly, there is a test or proving can be asked for when there's a sincere heart struggling to grow in trust, but finding itself weak, finding itself basically unable to move ahead. So I want to be clear. I do not believe that God gratifies those who either know and do not accept, or those who really have no desire to know about him, but just want the excitement, the flash, the bang, whatever. I don't think God rewards that. But when there's a heart crying for help in the midst of a battle to trust, even when there's doubt mixed in, as I look at Scripture and as I've what I've witnessed of life, I think God is ready and willing to answer such a call. Again, consider, for all Gideon's asking of signs from God, God actually gave him more than what he asked for. He didn't just say, "Gideon, stop." Now maybe if Gideon would have kept going, he would have reached that place. To ask for a sign for my own advancement, for my own glory, to try to force God to convince me of what he has already revealed would be wrong. Matthew 12, verse 38 through 40, just listen to these. "Then certain of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, 'Master, we would see a sign from thee.'" In other words, Jesus, prove to us, show us something that here. "But he answered and said unto them, 'An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given it, but the sign of the prophet Jonas. For as Jonas was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." Now it was interesting to me that even where you have the Pharisees, no desire to, at least overall, to follow Christ, no desire to seek God, just sort of prove yourself to us, even those, God didn't just, Christ didn't flat say, "No sign will be given you." But he said, "There is a sign, but you have to look for it." And he gave the sign of his death and resurrection. I think there is a big difference between those seeking God and yearning to know him, yet struggling with doubts, struggling with uncertainty, versus a skeptic that puts the onus, the burden of proof, of convincing on God. A person who out of unbelief asks for a sign is basically saying, "Convince me, God, if you can." This is not something God will necessarily answer, even though he could. But a person who is struggling in faith and says, Lord, I believe, or at least I want to believe, please help me in my unbelief. I believe that person will receive an answer from God. The test in that answer may be the accompanying command. You notice every time Gideon asked for a sign, God granted that, but then he also gave him something to do right afterwards. And I think that's, if you're going to ask God for a sign, and then you're not going to follow through with what he gives you to do in relation to the sign, then you've got a problem. You'd be much better off not asking for it. At the same time, if you're willing to follow through like Gideon did, I don't know that I can say that that would be wrong. I want to consider a few other things. I've preached out of Job already, so I won't go into that one deep. But would you say Job knew God before his calamities began? I think we all would, wouldn't we? He lived before Christ. I don't know if we call him a Christian, but I think Job would have definitely classified as a Christian in our day. I'll just read two verses. Job 1, verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and the man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed or avoided evil. Verse 5, and it was so, when the days of their feasting, his children were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually. Sounds like very far from a heathen man, doesn't it? Yet, after all Job experienced, after all that talking around the circle and blaming and countering blame and that whole thing. And Job asking God, oh, that I could just talk to you face to face and present my cause before you and all that. And Job chapter 42, verse 5 and 6, we have Job, after God questioned, here I am. Have it now. Have your way. Job in verse 42, verse 5 says, I have heard of thee, meaning God, by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. And I'm not wise enough. It seems like there was some conflict between God and Satan is given to us as the reason why Job experienced what he did. But if I may not be too presumptuous in suggesting that I really think why God allowed all that wasn't so much Satan's goading as that Job, for all his love of God, for all his desire for God, for all his carefulness and even concern for his children, I think Job had God in a box. I think Job thought he knew God. He thought he knew how God worked. He thought he understood this, and he became, can I say, somewhat presumptuous, somewhat wise in his own opinion of God. And God saw this as a way of showing Job, taking it from, I have heard by the hearing of the ear, secondary information, to taking it to a personal relationship that brought God out of the box in Job's life. May I further suggest to you that no meaning and fulfilling relationship comes without tests. You know, if a couple is in courtship and you ask them how it's going, they say, oh, perfect, fine, we never have any stress. You know that couple isn't quite ready to go bump life yet, are they? Because no matter how much you love each other, there's just bound to be something come up. And life consists of working, even a good relationship consists of tests, and I detest tests as much as anyone, don't misunderstand me. At the same time, isn't it the tests that finally define how much confidence I have in my relationship? Without being tested, without knowing, is my wife going to stick with me even when I have a bad day, how do I know how much trust I can put there? It is through the trying and the testing that confidence is built and commitment is deepened. I had to think of Hebrews chapter 12, verse 6 says, for whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. As God refines me through the difficulties of life and relationships, should I be so unfair as to accuse him of being unwilling to show himself to me? Psalm 103, verse 13 and 14. Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him. For he knoweth our frame. He remembereth that we are dust. And again, I would like to emphasize to you, yes, we don't go to God. We don't ask for signs and wonders so that we can be some great thing or because we're too lazy to go to the Bible and really study because we don't really feel like prayer and fasting at all. No, absolutely not. But if through those things life is still difficult, we're still not sure which way to turn, I firmly believe I serve a God who is more than happy to answer his son or his daughter if they ask him for a sign in humility and in respect. I had to think of Peter. You know, there at Christ's crucifixion, he's standing there denying Christ three times, vehemently the one time, even blasphemously. And yet, a fairly short time later, he is preaching to thousands about Christ at Pentecost. What was the difference between the Peter at the before the crucifixion and the Peter at Pentecost? I'd like to suggest to you that the former Peter, the one before Christ's crucifixion, had not yet maybe been tried fully by God, but also had not yet fully tried God. Yes, he'd walked with Christ. He'd seen and admired, no doubt, Christ's life and work. And yet, in that appreciation, there was still not a personal experience of what Christ actually does in my life. There was no power, there was no conviction in his life. I'm talking of before. In this way, coming to Christ as a repentant sinner is actually testing God, if you will, to the fullest extent. Because after all, who could love a sinner like I have been? But as we come to Christ, as we ask his forgiveness, and as we accept that forgiveness, it can and probably even difficult to believe that he would love me. Yet by faith I accept it. And in that very acceptance, I'm saying, I'm testing you, God, that you could love me. And I'm going to try to live for you through this. Without personal experience, without testing on both sides, a relationship will not progress and blossom. Many Christians today are seeking to serve a God. What they don't think they're realizing is that they are serving a God of their box, an untested, untried ideal of their own imaginative making. Then when they're hit with the realities of life and of God and of the way things, of how God sometimes views and does things, they fail and they fall because it's outside the perimeters of the box of God. God just is not allowed to work this way, is almost what it seems like. I'll just say this to you all. While to some degree and in many ways, my understanding and experience of God has increased, I would say, I find that my knowledge, what I think I know about God, has decreased. Can you follow me? Has decreased. What I could have confidently and may have even confidently told you about God and his ways some years ago, I'm not so sure I could say as certainly today. Not because of a lack on God's part, but because I failed in letting God be God and I tried to have this box that I could clearly define. And I see this sometimes, and it comes out in different ways, but one thing that stood out to me recently is there were some people studying through the Old Testament, and they came upon some customs and things that God had even required of his people. And these were Christian people, and their mouth literally fell open that God would do that or ask that. And see, so if you do that, you put God in a box. Because now he did something. How are you going to reconcile this with the God of your box? So much of what I thought I knew, I discovered was the box that I had been keeping God in. And you know, in keeping God in his box, it gave me the opportunity to hide, to cover the real thing, to where God just shouldn't do certain things because he is this way. I did this partly because of secondhand knowledge, but also because of fear and a lack of commitment. You know, if I insist on continuing down the path of having God in his box, I will miss the substance and the relationship that could have been had with the real God. Now, not the God of my box. I fear for myself. Am I content to know God without trying, testing God? When he seeks to test me, do I run and hide in confusion and fear? Do I seek to keep God in the box of my foolish philosophy and human endeavors? Or do I just open myself to him and say, God, this frankly doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand how, why this could have been or you could do this. But I'm going to trust you. And in that trusting, I'm afraid I'm going to have to try you. But I want to walk in your ways. Will I allow God to burst the boundaries of my box and show himself real to me? Will I prove him, not in doubt or rebellion, but in an effort at faith and trust? So how is it with you? I'd like to challenge each one of you. Do you really know God? Or do you just know a box? Have you tried God? Have you allowed him to come out of his box in your life? Is my belief in God a comforting, maybe even prized possession, but limited in usefulness by the boundaries I have set through my ignorance and fear? Is my belief in God that which tries me, refines me, it draws me, expands me, stretches me? As I find him faithful in all that he has promised, how much of God do I want? Am I willing to test God, knowing that with testing, I will be tested? Let me stand for prayer.